On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Kevin Kinghorn about his work on God and value judgment. So we cover all sorts of topics like, what is a value judgment? Are these beliefs with cognitive content at all? Or are they just sentiments? Or are they something else? What does it mean to call intuitive judgments quasi-perceptions? Are our value judgments from God? In what sense are they from God if they are? Are they special revelation? Are they natural revelation? Or are they something in between? How are they formed? And what are the implications for our views on this and spiritual formation? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of The London Lyceum. I am one of your hosts, Jordan Svaniak, and I'm joined by Dr. Joseph Dunn.
And we are a podcast that is all about serious thinking for a serious church. And when we talk about that, we try to describe it in a way of things like creating or cultivating an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. And so what that really means is that we should take arguments seriously. We should think at the highest level. We should engage the best resources. But we should do it in a responsible and fair-minded way and realize that there are friends to be made all along the path, whether we agree with people or not. There's opportunities to learn and grow from all sorts of people. And so that's what we do with the podcast. We talk to all sorts of people. We learn new things. We find out things that we think is crazy. And then we have a good time with that. And so let's just let's go ahead and get started now. We're going to talk with Dr. Kevin Kinghorn. If you all don't know him, he's at Asbury Theological Seminary. Though I get confused if it, you know, there's like this bifurcation between the university and the seminary, so he can explain that for me. But Kevin, before we get started, tell me a little bit about yourself. We're going to be talking about your new Cambridge Elements book on value judgments. So this should be a lot of fun. So just give me a little bit of the lay of the land, who you are, what you do, and maybe what was it that first got you interested in this particular material?
Yeah, so okay, I'm professor of philosophy and religion at Asbury Theological Seminary in Kentucky, as you mentioned. The college is separate, by the way, from the university. So sometimes the seminary or theological college is a kind of a department of the university. We're quite a separate institution, but we're right in a tiny town together. And so we have so far gotten along really well, got lots of good colleagues over there, but we are separate. So I've been teaching there since 2006. Prior to that, I was 12 years living in the UK. My dissertation was on the nature of faith. So that was really my early years, what I was really interested in. What decision exactly are we making when we put our faith in Christ? Is it a belief, an act of trust, obedience, something else? But the last 5 or 10 years, I'd say, really gotten more into moral philosophy. Just been struck by the number of really interesting questions in moral philosophy and branched a little bit into moral psychology just because the moral psychologists were coming up with all these very interesting studies on how we form moral judgments, among other things. So this Cambridge Element book, yeah, on God and value judgments. I wrote a book a few years ago on the nature of desert claims. So I've been very interested in what it means to deserve something. So this short elements book came partly out of that book on desert and partly out of a project I've had the last 2 or 3 years on moral intuitions, what they are, what kind of mental state they are, and the implications that one's view about moral intuitions have for things like spiritual formation and for a number of theological doctrines. So that's kind of who I am, what I've been doing the last few years. Was there another question in there that I missed that you'd asked, Jordan?
No, I think that's great.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Professor Kinghorn. So just as a quick kind of orienting question, you know, when people hear the word value judgment, at least like my students or, you know, just your average churchgoer, you know, my friends who aren't necessarily acquainted well with philosophy, they're probably going to hear something like moral belief, you know, like, oh, what you think about abortion or what you think about physician-assisted suicide. So just for the sake of clarity and, you know, defining our terms, could you elaborate for us when we say value judgment, what do we mean? Do we mean something just like a belief? Do we mean something a little more? Do we mean something totally other than belief? So if you could unpack that for us, that'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, two words there, value and judgment. So the value part, I would see generally is just any evaluation, any evaluative judgment that you make, that some things are better than other things, some pursuits more worth doing than other pursuits, some objects more worth contemplating than other objects. Anything like that is an evaluation. It's a value judgment. It involves what you ought to do or what would be better to do than some other thing. But now judgment, that's kind of the million-dollar question. What is a judgment? I mean, you hear that term, you think, well, this is a very deliberative process. It's like what judges do. You know, they consider evidence carefully and they render a judgment in the end. And that's just a belief. It's a conclusion based on evidence. Well, probably some value judgments do come as a process of evidence assessment and deliberation. But I rather think that just from the literature of moral psychology, that most of our value judgments are much more immediately formed. They're intuitive. They're immediate. We find ourselves just thinking, well, of course it would be better for me to shovel the snow off my elderly lady neighbor's sidewalk than to throw eggs at her window. I mean, that's just obvious. I don't need to collect evidence. I don't need to consult the parables of Jesus to figure that out. It's obvious, patently obvious. So how many of our moral judgments, our value judgments, are in fact immediately formed? Well, it's an open question. I rather think most of them. So for those more immediately formed value judgments, are they in the end a kind of belief, or are they in the end on the affection side? That is a kind of desire or emotional response. That now is the million-dollar question. I, just from the research and findings of moral psychology, I tend very much to think that they are probably very much an emotional response. And there's a number of reasons for that. I'll just take you through three really quick ones. First, moral judgments immediately formed seem always to motivate us. Like if I think it's a good thing, a valuable thing for me to do something, it just seems to entail that I've got some kind of motivation to do it. Well, it's our desires, not our beliefs, that motivate us, following David Hume. You could push back if you want against that, but I think that's a Humean kind of view of action explanation is pretty compelling. Desires motivate us, not beliefs. The second piece of evidence is the findings from moral psychology that you can greatly impact someone's value judgments by changing the ambience of a room, the lighting of a room, whether the smells in a room, whether the room is neat or disgusting and dirty, things that have got nothing to do with reasons or calculations or inferences. They're just changing someone's emotions. You change someone's emotions and you can greatly alter their value judgments. And then the third piece of supporting evidence just comes from brain imaging. It turns out from brain injuries, you can mess with just about any area of the brain, have it damaged, and people can still make value judgments and have the same value judgments they had before the accident that injured the brain. But if that part of the brain involved in emotional response gets damaged, people's value judgments go haywire. They change, they become unable to make value judgments. So there seems to be, from people who do brain imaging, again, I'm not one of them, but just reading the research, a really close correlation between people's immediate value judgments and the emotional centers of the brain. You put all those three together, and it seems to me you begin to start to have a fairly compelling case that our immediately formed value judgments are largely emotional responses to situations. And then if that's right, then the question for Christians, at least one of the questions, becomes, well, what does that mean then for our spiritual formation? How do we help form people to make the kind of value judgments God wants them to make? Do we just continue to bombard them with information, or do we try to cultivate our emotions? I mentioned in this Elements book, some theologians historically have said, well, that would be a sad fact if our value judgments are captive to our emotions. Emotions are fickle. We need to move past that in a cool hour, do some kind of clear, level-headed thinking. Other theologians maybe want to lean into this and say, well, emotions are part of who we are as humans. Let's help form people's emotions so that we form the value judgments God wants us to form. So the big takeaway point is simply that one's answer to the question, what are value judgments? Are they more beliefs cognitively formed, you know, on the basis of evidence, or are they more emotional responses, has huge impact for what you think spiritual, effective spiritual formation is going to look like.
So what are the main reasons that you've encountered for people who want to prioritize the belief aspect and say that those are more reasonably what we would consider value judgments?
Yeah. Why do they think that? Well, the biggest reason, and I don't want to be too snide, but the biggest reason seems to be history's on their side. That's kind of like the historical view.
Does this map onto like the intellectualist versus voluntarist sort of ish debates in any way?
I'm not sure. Could you say more, Jordan, about what particular?
So I guess, and Joseph, you may have better insight into this than I do, but I'm thinking of like the priority of the intellect versus the will in decision making. So sort of like medieval and then reform sort of debates on like what's prior in, and I don't know if it maps exactly onto this discussion, but in my mind, it seems to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think certainly relevant. I mean, there's some overlapping discussions. So the main modern discussion and the one I've kind of been more interested in is are these, what kind of state, mental state are these things? Are they more emotional responses, kind of seeming that's non-cognitive, or are they strictly beliefs? The more medieval discussion, of course, is where does the will fit? If you're asking where does the will fit into all this, that's a kind of it's a good question. It's a complicated question that's going to involve what you think action explanation amounts to. So let me just quickly give you the Humean model, and I'm like on board with this model, and so I have a hard time fitting someone like Aquinas into modern discussions, because among modern philosophers, and frankly, I'm one of them, I kind of buy David Hume's broad explanation. His explanation is that desires alone motivate us. Beliefs merely guide our actions. They explain why I attempt to achieve my desired goal by performing this action rather than that action. But beliefs don't do the motivating themselves. So will comes in and the point of choosing between various desires I have. So it's not really a choice between belief and anything else. It's a choice between desired goals. Desire to keep on my diet or to desire to eat the coconut cream pie. Different desires I have. So it's relevant to the discussion, but really the discussion that I'm interested in the book at least, is the discussion of what a judgment is. Now, what we do with that judgment, you know, I might value this, find myself valuing that, and then the will comes in choosing between these valued goals I have. But I'm kind of interested in the prior question of what is it even to make a value judgment? Is that itself a belief, or is that an emotional response of some kind that then leads to a belief?
Yeah, that makes sense. So I feel like I've got six follow-up questions, so I don't know where to start, but I guess I'm going to start with, you spend a good amount of time of like our value judgments from God, and if they are, in what sense they're from God, if, you know, if they're sort of like communicative experiences of some sort. So I'd love for you to like, kind of like explain that aspect of it.
Well, I absolutely believe that our value judgments are a key form of divine communication to us, that God is at work in the world, that he's pursuing certain goals, certain ends. He's inviting us. He's prompting us to pursue these ends with him. Hugely on board with that. And I think that value judgments are a really key way that God guides us in this. Value judgments properly formed, helping us prioritize according to his priorities, helping us pursue things that he wants us to pursue. He does this largely, I take it, through value judgments, which would then be a form of, you could call it prevenient grace or common grace given to all people. We're all capable humans of forming value judgments, of thinking some pursuits are better, more noble, more worth doing than other things. Yeah, I would think this is a key way that God intends to guide us.
So along that line, would you consider these sort of the ways that God is, I don't know, communicating to us, is this a form of special or natural revelation?
I think it could be a form of special revelation. I might form a particular value judgment. I might hear a story about some flawed judicial system in some country or some wonderful activity of Doctors Without Borders in some country, and I might just be struck of how valuable something is or how disvaluable something is. And that might be a form of God leading me to be a missionary to that region. Sometimes missionaries will explain why they've devoted their lives to some culture or some group of people. They'll say, well, God has given me a heart for these people. And I think that can be a form of special revelation to people, a particular value judgment they make about something's positive or negative value somewhere that motivates them, leads them to you know, take up to the mission field or something like that. But generally, I would call it a form of general revelation available to all people. All people can do them, can form these things. God intends for all people to form them. So yeah, by and large, I would consider it primarily a form of general revelation, yeah, to all people.
So, Professor Kinghorn, I wanted to go back just a little bit here, because for some of our listeners, maybe they hear the word Humean and they get a little nervous, right? So,
No. You know, he's the baddie, right?
That's right. Yeah, the atheist you know, is this hard empiricist and, you know, so on and so forth. So, you know, one of the things I want, if you could talk through for us, is just in thinking that value judgments have this strong affective, emotive, intuitive side, sentimental side, what role does reason play? I mean, doesn't this lend itself, this Humean view lend itself to subjectivism and just mere emotivism, you know, talking about our emotions, who's right, who's wrong, yeah, how can we tell? So what role does reason play? How do we adjudicate between competing value judgments? How does this not devolve into just, that's how I feel, and that's just it?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a great question. It's such a multifaceted question. So just a couple points on which I think Hume was wrong. So maybe we'll more comfortable if I start there, where I think Hume was wrong. Well, I do think clearly all humans do have a telos designed by God, that there is their way we flourish. So I hold to a perfectionist account of well-being, meaning there are for all humans certain ways in which we are all either going to flourish or fail to flourish, that we're all created for the kind of perfected relationships of knowing and loving one another and serving God. That applies for everyone. Hume has no vision of a telos like that for humans, that we might be trying to, that God might be prompting us toward. I do think he's right about desires motivating us, but Hume seems to have a very, unlike him, because he's a very sophisticated philosopher, so a little contrary to form, kind of a naive view of our desires, like they're just given to us, like they can't really be shaped or formed, that they're not a product of perhaps lots of agonizing years of reasoning through issues that have shaped the desires we now have. He seems to have, maybe not naive, but underappreciate the ways our desires can be shaped and formed by things like reasoning, wrestling with issues, philosophizing about things. So I certainly don't want to take desires as simply given. There's nothing you can do to change them. They just are what they are. They very well could be a product, and typically are a product, of a number of past reasoning processes, yes, but a number of past decisions that people make that make them the kind of people they are, that have the desires they have. Hume seems to underappreciate that. I would very much say the relationship between reasoning, rationality, past decision-making, and our desires is very complicated. And Hume, unlike himself, frankly, seems to underappreciate that.
So along these lines, in some ways, are just the question of, like, how are these value judgments formed? I mean, if they're primarily desires, are there ways that my beliefs can have some sort of, like, downward causation on my desires ways?
I certainly would hope so. Yeah. I mean, I hear a sermon about the Good Samaritan and the pastor encourages me to reflect on which character I really am. And I suddenly think to myself, you know, my neighbor's got a lot of needs and I'm kind of like not doing anything about it. And I'm suddenly like, I have a number of emotions about this. Yeah. I think I should do something more, but I find myself maybe with a lot of, as you say, downward, it's impacting my emotions. Just the fact that I'm thinking through some issue. So yeah, I absolutely believe that reasoning and rationality has a lot to play in the formation of our emotions. I mean, how else are our emotions going to get impacted and changed other than reasoning the way through things? And of course, by acting in certain ways, like going and serving my neighbor, doing something that then impacts my emotions. So yeah, I think our emotions are downstream of a number of things. Our deliberative actions, our habits, patterns of that, but absolutely also our reasoning through things. Sure. Yeah.
So this seems to have a significant impact on spiritual formation and questions related to that. I'd love to hear how you'd unpack how a right understanding of value judgments does give us or aid us as we think about spiritual formation.
Yeah, well, so I have my views, but let me just very quickly note that theologians historically have had very different reactions or reactions, maybe viewpoints about the role of reasoning and the role of emotions. Some have been, Joseph Butler is a great example, accuses Wesley and others of enthusiasm and advocates that we should consider things in a cool hour, kind of move past the fickleness of emotions and just think about these things clearly. Let's come reason together. Other theologians have leaned into our emotions, have thought reason is quite fallen and not a reliable guide, and we should just open ourselves to the flow of the Spirit and very much a more emotional driven, that's more of a way to be sensitive to the movement of the Holy Spirit. It really depends on which theologian you ask. Let me just say, Jordan, for me, a big starting point and divide historically, there's lots of little divisions we just don't have time for, but a big divide historically is whether you think the main problem with humans is belief and unbelief, like unbelief is the main problem and everything else stems from that. So that's the tradition of Luther, Calvin, and I'm a Wesleyan, but Wesley as well, although I don't agree with him on this one. Or an alternative is to think that the main human problem is, following Augustine, disordered loves. We love the wrong things in the wrong order. We're emotionally attached to this when we shouldn't be attached to it as much as that. So it's a matter of our desires being skewed. Now, I'm not saying that these are mutually exclusive, like the problem is all cognitive or the problem is all emotional, but there is a fundamental dividing line among theologians historically about what is the fundamental first kind of sin from which all the other things flow. Is it disordered loves and desires, or is it belief and unbelief? So I happen to be more on the side of, I think the fundamental problem is disordered loves and desires, but that's me. And so for me then, spiritual formation has to heavily involve getting people in activities, whether in small group settings of accountability or works of service or something like that, that help change the emotions. Not that it's unimportant to give information. I'm a seminary professor. I give a lot of information in lectures. I think it's important. But fundamentally what changes people, I'm going to say, you have to start with the fact that we have disordered loves. Lots of theologians will disagree with me, but I'll just note that that's one key starting point that you got to kind of reflect and decide for yourself. What do you think the key problem is? And then what does spiritual formation look like to help repair that and lead people to an openness to this of the Spirit and participation in the kinds of relationships that God wants us to participate in.
So just if I could follow up on that. So this is so, you know, such a curious and cool point, I think, because, you know, for many of us, I'm thinking of even my own children here, right? Like we go through our questions and answers and our catechism, you know, most days, weeks, whatever, we're going through the questions, you know, who is God, you know, and so on and so forth. So if our formation should either equally or predominantly involve this reordering of our loves, of affecting our affections, reshaping them, reforming them, what place does catechesis have in our spiritual formation? And maybe we could brainstorm together and what other modes of formation aimed at the affections and not just the reason should we be considering? Ideas, any discussion in that way?
Yeah, no, thank you for that, because I certainly don't want to overstate and suggest that things like catechesis and just giving information about the doctrine of God are unimportant. I think they're terribly important. I just kind of was making a point of the fundamental problem humans have that need to be overcome. So catechesis has a huge role. It is a both and. It is a both and, Joseph. In terms of the formation practices that really do affect the emotions, though, I mean, I rather think most of the acts, so, you know, the traditional acts of piety and acts of mercy are primarily there to, you know, engage the emotions, to give us more of a heart for God, their God, you know, priorities that God has, desires that God has, seeing the world as he sees it, I think largely as a matter of prioritizing things as Christ prioritizes them. So just acts of mercy, visiting the sick, the imprisoned, the holy listening, that kind of thing. But then this is one big reason I'm a Wesleyan. Small accountability groups, I think, are irreplaceable. Where they're not information driven, they are just holding one another up and having experiences of connecting, which is not really an intellectual list of beliefs I hold about you. It's more of an affection that I come to have, a feeling of being known and loved as I know and love others. I think that is like we neglect small accountability groups to our peril. And I think Wesley was absolutely right about insisting that everyone be in small accountability groups. He wanted them to be what he called class meetings, information-based class meetings, like we would call it a Bible study. Those are important. But small accountability groups of connecting with others is critical, in my opinion. And that is, if I had to name one thing that engages the emotions, it would be that.
So how much can we trust these value judgments just based on, like, I know some of them, everybody just intuitively is going to agree, like, yes, we can trust certain ones. Yeah. But there's other ones that it's kind of like, well, how much should we give? I don't know. I guess, how much should we trust it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I give you a really easy answer. I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. The point I would want to make is that there's no getting around them. Like, it's no kind of like putting them, let's put them to a side, for example, and let's just have a plain reading of what the scriptures say. That's what I'm going to say, that no, value judgments come in innumerable ways in interpreting the scriptures. The very end of this element, I don't know if you happen to have gotten that far. It's at the very end. I give the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And there's just different ways to interpret that, what Jesus is trying to say, but it's based on your intuition about the nature of desert, which maybe we'll get to later. Here's another really easy one to understand about how value judgments are unavoidable. So let's go to a plain reading of the scripture and the fact that God created us. We'd say that, well, the fact that God created us certainly makes it more appropriate for God to give me commands than the milkman to give me commands. I mean, I should pay more attention to what God has said rather than the milkman, because he created me. But if I ask for an argument, why? Like, I've had students when I taught in the UK and non-Christian students would say, well, even if there is a God, I mean, why doesn't mean I have to worship him? Where does that come from? If you were trying to give an explanation though, why it's more appropriate to take seriously the commands of my creator rather than my milkman, there's really no argument. I mean, there's no argument that being a creator of something gives you a right to some kind of say-so in how the thing is used. If I build a house, I mean, John Locke's famous view of property rights, if I build a house with my own hands, it seems to give me a right or a standing to say what happens in the house more than your standing to say what happens in the house. But why? There's no further argument. At some point, you just got to say, well, intuitively, that seems right. That if I build something and you didn't build it, then I should have a certain right to it that you don't have. So that's a low-hanging fruit one. But there's a million and one different ways, I would say, that value judgments inevitably come in. When we form an ethical belief, we form an interpretation of scripture. Well, Jesus clearly couldn't have meant that by this parable. Why not? Well, this just doesn't seem like it would be in keeping with a loving God at all. I mean, there's no way a loving God would commit to that. That's just not consistent with love. A lot of that's just an intuitive judgment. So I would, instead of saying, let's move past them, I would say, let's try to cultivate them well. So by cultivating the fruit of the Spirit, things like that, so that our moral judgments, hopefully value judgments, will be more reliable. How reliable are they? I honestly don't know. I just want to say, let's make them more reliable. There's no moving past them.
So you mentioned intuitions and seemings and things. So, you know, the question that I have here is, in what sense do these intuitions, you know, it just seems like the builder has a greater claim here, right, than the person who didn't build, so on. So what epistemic status do these seemings or these intuitions have? In what sense do they count as evidence towards something. I know, you know, earlier in the book, in your element anyway, you referred to intuitive value judgments as quasi perceptions. And
yeah.
So there's some things about, you know, intuitions and seemings involved with this. You could expand on some of that. That'd be great.
Yeah. Right. So giving the Reader's Digest version of this is a little bit difficult, but here goes. The reason I call them, and it's not just me, there's some other philosophers that call them quasi perceptual things, is that among the immediately formed conclusions we reach. So I conclude that I think I was given a picture on my last birthday, a framed picture, because I memory, intuitions about memory, or like self-evident things of mathematics. 2 + 2 is surely 4. I mean, I just see it. Of all the intuitively formed conclusions we reach, it seems that value judgments most closely resemble perceptions, like visual, auditory perceptions, something like seeming to see a bird on the line out there. There's various reasons why. It's just too complicated to go into. But so moral seemings, value judgments, intuitively formed, are sort of like perceptual seemings, but they're not quite. There's some important differences. The chief one being that value judgments are internally motivating. I see a bird on a wire, it doesn't necessarily motivate me to do anything, but a value judgment does. So that's why we call them quasi perceptions. It's just to say, it's sort of like a perception. Of all the immediately formed judgments we make, value judgments seem to be most like perceptions, although they're not quite perceptions. So we have this just catch-all phrase, quasi perceptions. So that's why I land on that term, to call them quasi perceptions. The epistemic justification they give would be the same epistemic justification that comes with perception. But to spell out why that's so, I'm just going to give you a promissory note and say, well, trust me, they're most like perceptions. No, I think they are, but you got to take a deep dive into the literature to say why.
So we don't know exactly how reliable these are, but is there a distinction between, you know, a Christian and a non-Christian where we could say the reliability here is greater for a Christian than a non-Christian because of XYZ?
Yeah, I would like to hope so. I certainly would like to hope that at conversion and the beginning of the new birth, the new life, that we have access to the Holy Spirit and we open ourselves up to the transformation of the Holy Spirit, that should, in general, make our value judgments more and more reliable. I mean, that is the thought. That is the hope. I would have thought that should be our expectation. Do non-Christians have many times accurate value judgments? Well, yeah, I think so. Sure. I think it's a form of prevenient grace that God ensures that as a prompting. How much more reliable are Christians' intuitive value judgments? I don't really have an answer to that. I think our expectation should be that our value judgments should grow in their accuracy. And by accuracy, I mean they should more and more reflect the value judgments, that is the priorities that Christ himself has when he looks upon the world. That should be our expectation. And I think that should be our hope. And I hope it is the case, but I don't have any slide rule to say, you know, how much more accurate Christians' value judgments typically are. Don't have any kind of rubric about that.
So how do we navigate moral disagreement then? Intra-Christian, extra-Christian, how do we really put these value judgments on the table and begin differentiating, navigating disagreement?
Well, given that the literature, as you know, Joe, is full of studies that we use reasoning oftentimes to simply justify the more immediate emotional responses we make. If I weren't a Christian, I would be quite pessimistic about finding much about the prospects of progress. I would be very pessimistic. I think I would probably just resort to some kind of broad contractualism where we say, well, look, I don't care about your reasons for thinking this is so, and I don't care if you agree about anything about value, but we're just going to agree that certain behaviors are off limits and just make a contract that, like, that's as good as we can do. And you might say, well, isn't that sort of what we do in law and society? I don't know, maybe so. But that would be as hopeful as I could be. I'd be just very pessimistic about that. I would like to think that as Christians, though, call me an optimist. I would like to think that as we practice the disciplines together, we should have an expectation that as we cultivate more and more fruit of the Spirit, that our value judgments in general would come more and more into alignment. Now, I don't think they'll come into perfect alignment. I don't think necessarily they should. I think it very well may be proper that you, in your certain calling with your spiritual gifts, see things on a particular issue a bit different than I do, and that I need to understand that and learn from that. So I think that's entirely appropriate. But on a number of large issues, I think that some of our judgments, value judgments, we should expect them to come more and more in alignment if we're cultivating the spiritual fruit through the spiritual disciplines together. But there's a couple, and I mentioned in the book, that good Christians notoriously disagree about, and maybe we'll get to those, but I don't know the prospects for solving those. I've been trying to convince people in the last few years to take my view on these two big value judgments endemic to human life that I mentioned in the Elements book, but I don't know, success is limited so far. Don't seem to convince everyone.
I've got two questions here, and maybe this could be a dealer's choice here. You can pick up whichever one you want. Yeah. On the one hand, you made mention of the studies that, well, I suppose give us good reason for pessimism and cynicism. The likes of Jonathan Haidt's social intuitionism, This idea that you got the rider and the elephant analogy, the dog and the tail analogy. You mentioned both of those, but essentially the idea is we make these non-rational judgments initially, pre-reflectively, and then we ad hoc rationalize our reasons to ourselves autobiographically as to why we did this, and it's just totally made up. It's totally right. So there's a lot of pessimism then about our decision, how much conscious reasoning is involved in our formation of our moral judgments. So on the one hand, maybe you can answer this question: how does a Christian respond to the likes of Haidt and these extremely pessimistic studies? Or on the other hand, why don't we jump over to maybe some of those other questions that you were talking about? So this idea of the good life, just desserts that were at the end of the element. So Maybe you could pick either of those and go whichever direction you want.
Well, I could try to do the first one really quickly and then move to the second one. I think, first of all, Christians should name things that are true. And if it is true that, for instance, I've got so many examples. You probably do draw from daily life too. But I've got just example after example I could name where, say, someone is brought up on some disciplinary charge at work or something like that. I'm thinking way back from my work experience in life. And that charge is answered. But then there's something else. And that charge is answered. And there's something else. And the goalposts keep moving. You know that phrase, the goalposts keep moving. And you realize, well, look, it was never about this or this or this. They just don't like the person. They're going to find a reason to get him out. Now, that's never happened to me personally, but I have seen it happen to friends personally. It is extremely disturbing, upsetting, all that. I think Christians should name things for what they are. And that is, if it is true, and I think it is, that a lot of times we are just making emotional decisions and we're finding ways to justify it, that Christians should be the first ones speaking to that. Now, you got two options then. You move past it, like we need to get rid of the emotional stuff and do clear and think level-headed thinking. And I think that is appropriate to say at times. And another kind of response is, let's shape our emotions together so that we have less and less of these cases of sheer animus driving our decision-making. So both of those are appropriate. I think there's a lot more to be said, but let me just move to those other two if we have time. And I don't know how much time we have, but quickly, as quick as I can, the two big value judgments that I think are endemic to human life that I discuss in the Elements, that I'd like to raise them just because I'm always really interested in other people's intuitions on this. The first has to do with the nature of the good life. What is it to live a good life? And here you can either be a welfarist or a non-welfarist about the nature of the good. So briefly, if you're a welfarist about goodness, that means you think that all things, objects, activities, all things are good only insofar as they are good for someone. A non-welfarist thinks, no, some things are just objectively good in their own right. So here's two thought experiments, and I'm just going to probe you two to see what your intuitions lie on this. So here's, let me give you a thought experiment given by the non-welfarist, and then the thought experiment given by the welfarist. So here's the non-welfarist thought experiment. Let's suppose there's a beautiful painting, the Mona Lisa, a Rembrandt painting, that giant sycamore tree that was cut down in Hadrian's Wall, if you read that from last year. Anyway, some beautiful thing in nature or a piece of art that gets just destroyed by someone. Now, we all agree it would be bad for people because there'd be future generations who never get to see it. In addition to that, isn't it the case, says the non-welfarist, that such a destruction of a beautiful piece of art or a beautiful tree is just plain bad in its own right? Can't you see that something of beauty, something of excellence, something of worth has been destroyed? And so some things are just good in their own right. Don't you intuitively see that? So that's the one thought experiment. So here's the other thought experiment, and you have to see which is more compelling. The other thought experiment is this. Someone suggests to me that, well, the current state of the world has taken a turn for the worse. And I say, well, why is it worse? And you can't name me one single subject who has experienced their life as in any way going worse for them. And indeed, no one's life has been made worse off. There's no future generation of people that are going to be made any worse off. There's no subject who experiences a well-being whose life is any worse. If you can't name one person who's worse off, I'm a bit at a loss to understand how the world has taken a turn for the worse. No one's life as they live it has gotten any worse. That's the intuition of the welfarist. So again, the question is, do you think things are good only insofar as they are good for someone? Or do you think some things are just good in their own right, like paintings and trees? So just quickly, what's your intuition on that?
Yeah, this is a good one. So my first philosophical love was Plato.
Oh, dear.
So my intuitions were shaped toward goodness, simpliciter, in the sort of Robert Adams type way, right? Where it's like, man, when the tree got cut down, it's just a bad thing happened, you know? And even if we weren't around to see it, it still was bad. Even if it's not bad for us, it's still just bad. That's my intuitions, right? Yes. Anyway, but yeah, that's a really fascinating question. Jordan, I'd be interested to hear, because you're more Aristotelian with these things. So I'd be interested to hear what Jordan thinks.
So my intuitions actually do track along with Joseph in that there is goodness, simpliciter, despite my Aristotelianism and my aversion to Plato.
Right. So I can't convince you that like no one's life is made any worse. A rock doesn't experience a well-being. A painting doesn't experience a well-being. A tree doesn't. One's life as they live it is made any worse. And I just don't know but you think the world is still worse for a tree being cut down?
Yeah. I mean, I would have a hierarchy of sorts. So, I mean, it's like, you know, if a rock is a really beautiful rock is broken in two and it's no longer as pretty anymore, then, you know, it's like not nearly the same plane as a number of other atrocities that could happen that would make somebody's life objectively worse in their situation. But I would still think there's something intrinsic to that tree or whatever it is being ruined that's unfortunate and problematic.
Fair enough. So, and I don't necessarily want to argue one or the other. What I want to do in the Elements book is just say that your intuition about that, your value judgment about that has enormous implications for how you read Genesis, the declaration that this world was good, how you understand the character of God, the essential nature of God's goodness, claims that God is the good. So I won't trace those all out. I'll just say that there's a number of theological implications that flow from that. I think there's even more theological implications that flow from the second then big discussion about who deserves a good life. So just really quickly, the Reader's Digest overview is that in the history of discussions about desert, that is who deserves things, the conventional received wisdom is that the value of deserved treatment is in people getting treatment that is proportional to their moral character. So you've got a virtuous moral character, you deserve good fortune of some kind. You have a malicious, vicious moral character, you deserve bad treatment of some kind. So the villains at the end of Westerns deserve to get their comeuppance. You know, they deserve bad stuff. And saints in life, they deserve some, you know, to have some good outcome. All right. So everyone in philosophy agrees that desert has something to do with proportionality. But now here's the big intuitive value judgment. Is proportionality itself, that is the obtaining of proportional treatment itself, valuable, like non-instrumentally valuable? Just it's good in and of itself that good people get a good life and that bad people receive punishment? Or is it only instrumentally valuable because there's something else we value, something deeper? So this, on this one, I really do want to plump for one view. And I want to say that there's no intrinsic value in proportionality obtaining, even though that's the received wisdom. I think our concern for people getting what they deserve is our concern that the truth about people and how they've affected others be brought out in the public arena and acknowledged by all parties. I don't think we really value proportionality for its own sake. I think proportional treatment often helps bring the truth about someone to light. I mean, we hear of a corporation getting a huge fine or someone getting a long prison sentence for embezzlement, and we think, wow, their violations must have been really extensive. So it helps bring something to light. Or someone gets given a huge testimonial dinner. Well, they must have really contributed as a teacher to lots of students through their career. But proportional treatment doesn't always bring a person's traits to light. And I think situations like that where we're satisfied that someone has been given proportional treatment, we're still not satisfied that they've gotten what they deserve. And I bring out these cases in the Elements book. I think that shows that our deep concern was never really for proportionality. It was for the truth. I think what we really long for, and it's a God-given yearning, is a community of perfected relationships where we're known and loved mutually within community. And we recognize that we have to have a shared truthful narrative of who everyone is and how we've affected one another for that perfected community to take place. I think it's really instructive that at criminal trials, victim statements are read. So I mentioned, I think, in the book, the Larry Nassar trial in 2018, the gymnastics coach, his sentencing was a foregone conclusion. He pleaded guilty. The sentence was already given. But victims, they needed to read statements. They wanted him to know. They needed him to know, these are the ways I've been affected. This is the way it's affected all these other relationships in my life. And I need these other people to see this too. I think that's our deep yearning. We need the truth, a shared narrative to be exposed. And that's why we value proportional treatment. It's not that we value it for its own sake. Now, that's really quick, but this has enormous theological implications for a number of doctrines. The rationale, what would God keep people alive in hell? Would God punish unrepentant people? Is there value in God doing that? Well, if you think there's value in proportional treatment for its own sake, then you could make a case. But if not, then it's a lot harder to make a case. Your answer to that question about the nature, the value of deserved treatment has huge implications for how you understand divine justice. Is God's justice always restorative? Or is it at times retributive? Like just it's good in its own sake that unrepentant people get retributive punishment. So this and a number of issues really do stem, I want to claim in the book, from value judgments about the value of desert. And then the previous discussion we had about the value of, or I shouldn't say the value, but it's rather the nature of goodness. Like what's so valuable about things? Is it just intrinsic goodness, or are things good only insofar as they're good for people? Just want to make it the point in the book that these are endemic to human life, these value judgments, and they really do help settle a number of theological issues, or at least they have a number of theological implications. That's my spiel about those two big...
Yeah, this is great. So if you haven't gotten excited to go get a copy of the book, now you should, because there's all sorts of fun stuff to be thinking about and to work through. So before we wrap up, Kevin, do you have a website or anywhere that people can find a list of all your work?
No, not really. I've got a terribly, this is a shame of Asbury Seminary. I'm embarrassed to say our websites are so antiquated. So I've got a website. Yeah. I mean, you can look on Asbury Theological Seminary and under faculty, you find my name and you can find the website as it looked about 10 years ago. If that's helpful for you, go for it. Or you just email me.
Cool.
I'm always happy to talk about things. But yeah, I've written on, the academic stuff has been on the nature of faith and it's been on The Nature of Goodness. That's a 2016 Notre Dame book. And The Nature of Dessert, that's a Cambridge book from 2021. But a more accessible book is, I wrote one on divine wrath, like how to understand God's wrath. Because I kept on getting these, you know, I'm much more into the restorative justice camp, and I kept getting these kind of comments. Well, yeah, God is a God of restoration and love, but he's also a God of wrath, you know. So I wanted to try to give an account of wrath. So I'm really interested in that topic. And that's more of an accessible, popular level thing you can get from IVP.
But, awesome.
But anyway, not just books, but if anyone wants to talk about these issues, I'm always happy to talk about them just by personal email.
Tremendous. Well, this has been a ton of fun. I think we've all, at least I've enjoyed it, and I'm sure Joseph has too. He gets to nerd out a little bit on the podcast. So this has been a lot of fun. If you are interested in following along with Dr. Kinghorn's work, go check out his work and the Cambridge Elements series. I'll make sure to link to that. If I didn't mention that already, I can't remember now, but I'll put that in the show notes so you can go get a copy of it and keep up with the other work that he's doing. We appreciate people like him who have put forth their time and effort to studying important topics, to helping us think well about them. And so everybody's been tuning in. We appreciate you for listening, and we look forward to talking with you all soon as you've been listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com. Save